I'm actually going to read Ecclesiastes 12. So that's where we're going to be today. We're going to close out the book of Ecclesiastes. And so I'm going to read the whole thing, and then we'll jump in and look at it more in depth. It's Ecclesiastes 12, starting at verse 1. Remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come, and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, in the days when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few and those who look through the windows are dimmed and the doors on the street are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up at the sound of a bird and all the daughters of song are brought low, they are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheels broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Now, besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads and like nails firmly fixed, or the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. This is the word of the Lord. And I think of verse 12 there, just off the cuff, of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. And both Doc Noah and I don't believe that's true. But the only time I've ever actually gotten close to that, when I was at Powell's Books. Have you guys been at Powell's Books? And it's a whole block, a whole city block in Portland of layer upon layer of books. That's the only time I've ever been overwhelmed by how many books there are in the world. But other than that, that's just a total side note. To get to a really obscure book from the 18th century, there was a philosopher, a German philosopher in the 18th century, late 1800s, named Immanuel Kant. And he's well known, famous. You've probably never heard of him, but he wrote this little book in 1783 called The Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics. And he was talking about kind of his journey of thinking and his journey of discovering and some of the things that he wrote about. And he was reading another philosopher, the famous Scottish philosopher David Hume. And as he read Hume, some things in his reading jostled his mind. And he wrote this. He said, I was interrupted from my dogmatic slumber. And what he was saying there in those words is he was saying that this philosopher, David Hume, in his writings had basically taken a bucket of cold water and thrown it on him while he was in bed. I don't know if that's ever anything like that has ever happened to you. Only Wayne, you're the only one in each service that gets buckets of cold water. Do you do that, Vicky, or?
In the Marine Corps.
Oh, Marine Corps, okay. How about you, Dave? Nothing like that, okay. So we know that Wayne used to sleep in all the time in the Marine Corps. So that's kind of what he was saying. It was like this, he was in a rut and he got jostled out of it, or he was in a slumber and he got shocked out of it. And he's referring, of course, just to our human tendency to get into a rut, to live in such a way that we go through life without questioning what we know, without challenging or changing the status quo. And we as humans, we tend towards what's easiest, don't we? We tend towards what demands the least from us. But sometimes there's things in our lives that wake us up from our dogmatic slumber, and we're shocked awake, we're forced out of the norms of life, and often in those times we're confronted with a choice. And I've, over the last 3 months, and by the way, it's almost 3 months to the day since we had our last in-person services here, March 15th, 3 months ago tomorrow. And so we're back together. And we all know that we've been walking through this pandemic of the coronavirus. And in the scheme of things, 3 months isn't really a long time. But in a lot of ways, it probably feels like somebody threw a bucket of water on us and we're all just kind of shocked of what it's like and we're tired of it. Well, over that time, I've just spent a lot of time thinking and praying and talking with people about what God is doing in this time. And I'm trying to think, like, if he is working in this time, how is he doing it? And what does that mean for us as a people? What does it mean for us as individuals? What does it mean for us as a church? And I think this is something we should all continue to process over the coming days and weeks and months and even years. And I want to just give you a picture, a peek into how I'm wrestling with this right now, because it feels to me like God has used this coronavirus to bring forced change to our life, on a not just on a personal scale, not just on a local scale, but on a global scale. I mean, the entire economy of our world has changed. The way that people are living throughout the world has changed because of this. And it's not something we would have chosen. So if I were to come to everyone in the world back in February and said, okay, we're just taking a really simple poll, how many of you guys want to have a pandemic? You know, how would that vote have gone? You know, probably no. It'd probably be voted down even harder right now, but it's not something we would have ever chosen. God took us and put us in this. Let me give you another kind of pictorial example up here on the board we have a junction in a train track. And as I think about how life is normal or it was before the pandemic, that's track A there on the left-hand side. Just, it's straight. We know where it's going. It doesn't have, I mean, we can't see the whole thing, but let's imagine that it's not too bumpy. It's not too windy. It's not too steep. And for lack of a better word, we can just call that normal. That's normal life. That's our rut. That's our rail. That's where we live. It's comfortable. It's familiar. It's even enjoyable. And in fact, it's probably what we would call our preferred life. And now let's say that this coronavirus pandemic, in it, God has taken us from track A and transferred us to track B. And here we are in a completely different space. And when you're on a train, you get jostled around, you make a change like that, and it feels like things are shaken up. And again, this is on a global scale. We're finding that track B is quite different. We have to social distance. We have to wear masks. We have to hand sanitize. We can't do all the things that we wanted to do or eat at the restaurants we wanted to eat at or visit the places we wanted to visit. It's unusual. It's jarring. It's difficult. It's stressful. And yeah, there can be some different blessings that come with this time, but it feels more like an interruption to us. And when things like that happen, when we get jostled out of our norm, when a bucket of water gets thrown on us, we wake up and say, where are we going? What's happening? Why are things different? Why are we switching tracks? Can't we just get back to track A? Can't we get back to life as normal? How many of you have asked that in the last 3 months? Can we just get back to normal? But let me ask you this. What if in God's sovereignty, in what he's doing in this moment, track B is just like in the picture, a transfer point? It's a point where God is taking us somewhere else that he really wants us to be. And if you look at the picture, you can see that on the right-hand side of the screen, track B goes, and there's a juncture, there's a choice, there's a left-hand turn, a move that takes us back pretty close to normal, at least parallel, or a track that takes us off into the distance we know not where, this track C over there. What if I made a suggestion to you that God has put us in track B in this place, in this time, with the coronavirus so that he could get us over to track C, a place we would never choose for ourselves? And I think this is the question and the choice that lies before us as God's people right now. Will we go back to normal? Or will we choose to follow God in the new direction he's taking us? And I'm confident, you may not agree with me, but I'm confident, brothers and sisters, that those two things are not the same thing. And here's what has opened my eyes to what I think God might be doing here. There's a few things in play here as I'm thinking this. Again, you're getting a picture into my mind. So there's the coronavirus. And then in the past few weeks, we've had our country explode with racial tension that's erupted in every state, many of the major cities in our country, into a firestorm of conflict and opinions over here and over here, and anger and protests, protests that have turned to riots, calls for justice and reform. And if nothing else, if we honestly look at this time, if we honestly allow our eyes to be open to see what's happening, if we take a gut check in the moment, we should be aware, at least in some way, that for millions of people in our country and billions of people throughout the world, that the normal is not a good thing. It might be good and comfortable for you, but for many people who live in poverty, oppression, daily suffering, not having enough to eat, people are enslaved throughout the world. That normal is not a good thing. In fact, it's death. We've got coronavirus, we've got racial tensions in our country, and then we have this crazy thing called Ecclesiastes that God has put us in over the last 10 weeks or so. And we've been walking through this book together, and the teacher of Ecclesiastes tells us famously that there's a time for everything, including a time to study the book of Ecclesiastes. And I don't think it's an accident that God has put us in this book to grapple with it during a pandemic. And I didn't plan for that. Months ago, when I was planning out the wisdom literature, I did not think, okay, we're going to do Ecclesiastes when the pandemic hits in March. That was not in my mind. It was, I think, in God's mind. God did plan for this. And as negative and depressing as this book seems to be, as we read it, especially on the surface, it's written by a man who we call Koheleth, or the teacher. And what I appreciate about him, what I've come to observe and appreciate about him, and what is a beautiful part of this book, is a man who struggles, a man who brings despair at times, calls things vain or hebel or absurd. What we find in the teacher is a man who actually cares, who has the courage to take an honest look at the real world and be bothered by it, to look at the world and go, hold on, this isn't right. This doesn't add up. This isn't how it should be. And sometimes I think the question that we have to ask ourselves over and above every other question is the question of, do we care? Do I care? Do you care? You know, a couple weeks ago, I struggled with the decision whether or not to watch the video of George Floyd being killed. And I didn't want to. And I wrestled with it. And finally, I remembered actually a sermon by John Piper. And he was talking to pastors about how they engage with suffering in the world. And it's really easy for pastors to kind of, for us as leaders, to in our wherever we're at in our life, to kind of academicize, that's not even a word, but to kind of take ourselves back out of suffering and not really deal with it, talk about it, preach about it, but not be connected with it. And so what he said as a pastor is that he has a folder in one of his file drawers, and he keeps it full of pictures and images of the suffering of the world. Things that we don't want to look at, things that we don't want to see. People who are living in slavery, people who are starving, children who are being abused or aborted. These pictures of the horrible suffering and brokenness and sin and injustice that's in the world. And he said he would take that folder out every once in a while to look through it in order to protect himself from being detached from the brutal realities of the real world. And sometimes it can seem that we only get bothered by the injustice and the brokenness of the world when it affects me. But if we care, like the teacher of Ecclesiastes cares, then it follows that we won't go back to normal. We must be willing to change and to be changed. We must let God use this time, use this moment in all that it is to shake us out of our dogmatic slumber and to see the world as it really is, to see the world as God sees it, but not even just stop there, to love the world as God loves it. Because here's the truth. God will not let us have our preferred normal and at the same time, his preferred life for us. Now, sometimes those things intertwine and they're the same thing, but oftentimes we're pursuing our own American dream or our own desires over here, and God is calling us over here. And as we have studied the book of Ecclesiastes, hopefully we've been woken up to the fact that the world isn't as we want it to be, even isn't as it should be, and God is calling us to something new. He's calling us to care. And so as we wrap up Ecclesiastes today, I want to take us back here to chapter 12, verse 13. These are the words of the author of Ecclesiastes, who takes the words of the teacher and presents them to us and then kind of wraps it up with his own summary. And here's what he says in verse 13. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Fear God, keep his commandments. What does it mean to fear God? Well, simply put, fearing God is living mindful of him, living in his presence before his face. It's living as if God actually exists, that God made us, that he is our creator. And as a creator, he has certain rights over us. He has made us and we are his. And as such, we owe him our allegiance. And so we should live like he's real and that he actually has rights over us, that we submit to him. It's a life completely oriented around him. At the beginning of the chapter, the words of the teacher are these, which can be summarized to be fear God. But he says, remember also your creator in the days of your youth. And I think there's three things that come out in Ecclesiastes that define what fearing God means. And I want to just walk through those three real quickly. The first one is that we should live a grateful life. There are several passages throughout Ecclesiastes where the teacher tells us to enjoy life, enjoy food, enjoy the fruits of your toil, enjoy your wife, your husband, enjoy the life that God has given you in the now. And that's a theme throughout the book. It's not a call just to pursue pleasure for pleasure's sake or to pursue these things because they can fulfill your deepest needs or so that you can find control and profit. What it is to enjoy the gifts of God because they've been given by a giver. Not to worship them, not to draw our attention to them, but to use them and to enjoy them to draw our attention to the giver. And so we do that by living grateful lives, by saying thank you, by enjoying the gifts that he's given us. Secondly, fearing God in Ecclesiastes means living a submitted life, recognizing that God is in control and we are not. And throughout the teacher, you know, he recognizes about God. God knows the beginning from the end, but we don't even know which way's up and which way's down sometimes. God knows it all, and his ways are sometimes mysterious and confusing, difficult, even frustrating, but in the end, he is king and we are not. And if he is king, then we can't be. And so to live fearing him is to live a life submitted to the king, submitted to his sovereignty, to his wisdom. And this is the true nature of faith, a life submitted to the king. So fearing God, we live a grateful life, we live a submitted life, and then we live an unwasted life, which, by the way, unwasted is not in the dictionary. It is a spell check nightmare. So I had to hyphenate it. Live an unwasted life. And this is implicit in that first verse of chapter 12, if you look there. Remember also your creator in the days of your youth. And in the first eight verses here of chapter 12, in this kind of metaphorical flourish, the teacher appeals to the young ears of those who are listening to him. And he's basically saying, don't wait until you're old and dying to fear God. So he paints this picture of what old age looks like. And he says, basically, if you wait until the end of your life, if you wait until everything's kind of falling apart and you're heading to the grave and these are your last days, if you live your life and the end is reached without remembering and fearing your Creator, then that is a life that is wasted. And another way to state that is that our faith or our relationship with Jesus, our fearing of God, must take shape in the real world. It must affect our lives now, not just be something that affects them down the road or when we're later or when we're older. There's a heresy that I think is actually prevalent in the church, and it's been prevalent a long time. And it's a heresy that I call fire insurance salvation. And it's the idea that faith, in its essence, is like taking out an eternal fire insurance policy to keep us out of hell when we die. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Okay, so you might remember back in the 80s or 90s, I don't know if you remember these, but these were cool when I was a kid. Oakleys, these sunglasses. You guys heard of Oakley? Anybody? I'm dating myself here. Okay, yeah. Those who were alive back then. In the 80s, it was kind of towards the end of the Cold War, but it had been a fear for a long time that of geothermonuclear war, right? That this was going to be the big thing. Nuclear war was going to happen, maybe. We were afraid of that. And so Oakley tapped into that, and they said, you know what? Our sunglasses, and this was their motto, our sunglasses offer thermonuclear protection, which basically means protection from the sun, but it was kind of this ploy to like, hey, if a nuclear war happens and you have Oakleys, you're going to be just fine. Or at least your eyes will survive, you know. Well, the Christian marketers grabbed a hold of this. They thought, hey, kids love this. This is cool. Let's put it on a t-shirt and replace Oakley with Jesus. And so I bought the t-shirt. And it said Jesus in that very font, Jesus. And underneath, instead of thermonuclear protection, it said eternal combustion protection. So think about that for a second. and we laugh at that. That's a t-shirt I wore proudly in high school. In fact, I think I got some of my senior pictures in that t-shirt. We laugh, but underneath that is a dangerous belief that faith in Jesus is like an insurance policy that I take out to be redeemed on a judgment day, on the judgment day. And that's when it's useful. But what do we do with our insurance policies? Stick them in a drawer, shut the drawer, lock the drawer, and wonder where they are when we need them, right? Like, we have to go find them when we need them, when they really matter, okay? We don't take our insurance policies and put them on the mantle as a centerpiece for our living room. We don't hang them on the wall, framed. We don't take them to our dining room table and in the morning with a cup of coffee, read through them. We don't underline things in them. We don't love our insurance policies. Our insurance policies don't love us. We don't have a relationship with them. We don't pray to them. We don't worship them. We don't fear them. What our insurance policies are things that give us peace of mind about the future so that we can better function as we pursue the things that are really important to us today. And sometimes we treat Jesus like that. He's someone who's going to help me in the future, but that gives me peace so that I can really do the things that I want to do today. You see, true faith is a fear of God relationship with the King that we love, who loves us, that we adore and we worship and we fear. It's a fear of God relationship that submits to Jesus as our beloved King now and every day through eternity. It's a faith that's not content to waste our life on things that only matter to us, but to give our life for kingdom things. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. I'm curious how you hear the command here to keep God's commandments in this verse 13. Does it sound like a burden to you? Or does it feel like freedom? You know, one time a man came up to Jesus and he asked him, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" And Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. A second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And on these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets." We're not without precedent biblically. We're not without excuse either. We're without excuse in summarizing the final word of Ecclesiastes, fear God and keep his commandments. In summarizing that statement, Ecclesiastes' great search for meaning is simply this: love God, love others. And love of God means not being content with the brokenness of the world that the teacher lays out for us. Not being content with the normals of injustice and sin and absurdity. It means not allowing ourselves to continue in our dogmatic slumber, but rather waking up to care about the contradictions and the sufferings and the oppressions and the injustices and the brokennesses of the world, and then seeking to bring the love of Christ and the gospel of our King to bear wherever and however we can. And for that to happen is going to take a choice. It's going to take a choice of sacrifice, of being willing to follow Jesus in laying down our lives. It's going to take being unpopular, even being rejected, even being lonely. And so the end of the matter, love God, love others. And I really believe, I put this up on the screen because I think it's an important statement, really believe that Ecclesiastes in its entirety answers the question of meaning and purpose for us. That's what it was written for, and I think it actually answers it. That the incongruities and the injustices and the contradictions and all the absurdities of life, these are the very places in which we love God and others. We don't love God and others by staying above the fray, by staying out of it, by not caring. It's the incongruities, the injustices, the contradictions, the absurdities of life. These are the places in which we love God and others. And that's our choice. Back to this picture of the railway line. That's our choice, choice C up there. What will we do with this moment? What will we do with this time that God has put us in? Will we be awakened from our dogmatic slumber and follow God into His preferred future? Or will we just kind of pull the covers back up and roll over and go back to sleep, just happy to return to our preferred normal, unchanged, unencumbered, uncaring about the weight of the world and the weight of His kingdom? And friends, I think, brothers and sisters, I think that we have to choose track C. God's future, His mission, His ambition, His desire has to be our chosen future. It's the only way that we can fear Him and keep His commandments. So let's not waste this moment. Will you pray with me? Father, it's actually been a joy to study and preach through Ecclesiastes, which I don't know if I ever would have said that before. With all its contradictions and all its struggles and all what seems to be just negativity and almost even passages that we are nervous about reading and calling your word, and yet you've put the teachings of the teacher in front of us and allowed us to grapple with them. And in the end, Lord, I hope that we've grappled with you as well, that we've wrestled with you and how you want us to live and what you want us to be about and how you want us to believe and especially how you would have us to love others. So Father, as we go this day, may we not waste this moment that includes a worldwide pandemic, that includes an uproar in our country about racial injustice and injustice as a whole. And as we look at Ecclesiastes, knowing, God, that the world is not the way it ought to be. And you've put us in this world to love others. You've put us in this world to make disciples. You've put us in the world to be salt and light. And may we not take our comfort for granted, but may we use our comfort and our privilege and whatever you've given to us, Lord, to love. So as we continue in worship, as we go our way this week, would you draw our minds to how you would have us engage as we follow you, our beloved King. It's in your name that we pray. Amen.